From Peter Frederick's poem, Each New Day. Birds do not worry the morning or fret the rising sun. They wait, expectant, until its rays kiss their downy necks. Then, stretching, they turn to face the day and sing. Dr. Jody Clark will now make his presentation.
Margaret, thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here. How are you guys?
Good.
Excellent. So what I've been doing for the last 25 minutes or so is drinking as much of you as I possibly can, because it's really one of the big challenges when you speak. If you don't know the people you're speaking with, it's really the biggest challenge of all. The reason I say that is years ago I was I'm an Anglican priest, and I was visiting St. John's, Newfoundland. And my uncle, Uncle Norman, who died a few years ago, but was really very close to him, he was the warden, which is kind of the chief layperson in the parish of St. Thomas's, which is in downtown St. John's. And Saturday night I was having a dinner with my Uncle Norm, and I said, Uncle Norm, and I didn't know what the parish was struggling with. I was invited as their guest speaker, and it was a great honor, but I didn't know the community very well. And so here my uncle, who's the warden, chief lay guy in the parish, I'm sitting with him. I said, Uncle Norm, you know, what should I preach about? Because I don't want to be insensitive. I don't want to offend anybody. I want to try to capture what's going on in the life of the congregation. So I said, Uncle Norm, what should I preach about? And he said, 10 minutes. That's exactly what happened. So with that, I asked Margaret a little while ago how long I should preach. She said, 45 minutes to an hour. She didn't say that, actually. I'm going to put my clock on, just because sometimes you guys can carry it away. So I'm going to put on, she said 15 minutes, actually. Is that right, Margaret? 15, 20, she said, okay. I'll put 15 on and see what happens, because I've already kind of spent it sometimes. Super duper, great. The alarm will go off, so you can all sit back. The other thing I want to say, too, is that one of my mentors is an old Anglican priest. His name is Isaac Butler, and Isaac is such a gem of a man. And Isaac would say, too, so it's a Sunday morning. I don't know what your day was like last night or your morning's been like, but if through my address you feel like you need to go to sleep, go to sleep. Because often guest speakers, I don't know if you know about this, but when guest speakers speak and people start dozing off, they raise their voices. Right? Or they take it as a personal affront that I was so boring you fell asleep. And Isaac said to me once, he said, Jody, you don't know what people were doing the night before. You don't know if they're up all night, if they're visiting in the hospital, or if they just come off a long shift. But they're there in church, they're there worshiping, and they're so comfortable in your presence that they can fall asleep. And I said, so I have never taken offense when people fall asleep or start snoring or drooling or anything. Like, don't worry. And if, in fact, you start to do that, I will actually lower my voice so that you can rest. Would it be okay? So just a bit of introduction. So it's really an honor to be here. Norman's asked me a few times to come, and I haven't been able to come. Usually I take my mom to church. My mom's 90 years old, and I take her to church, and it kind of books a lot of my Sundays. But last night I took her to Berwick, Nova Scotia, and Little Anglican Church there did a dinner theater. They make $20,000 with their dinner theater. And it's really, a pretty amazing thing. And anyway, my sister was in the show last night, so I took my mom. I think my mom is sleeping in today. So I knew that in the schedule, so when we arranged the time, Norm and I often have coffee together, not as often as I'd like, and not as often as Norm would like. So I feel like I know a little bit about you, but Norm has become a very dear friend and a treasured friend, so it's great to be with you today. Well, he's just back from sabbatical, I guess, so good. So this is, the title is The Minimalist, I've already been 10 minutes into my sermon, right? This is The Minimalist Guide to the Galaxy, and it really is about needing less in life. Now, the other thing, I'm a CBC-holic. I don't know if you guys are. But just before, and I didn't hear the whole show, but the Radio Noon show had a call-in show just before Good Friday. Maybe it's a Thursday before Good Friday. And the question was whether or not we should have Good Friday, whether Good Friday should be a statutory holiday or not. And I didn't hear all the calling in. But I wanted to call in. And I wanted to call in for a really important reason, because I'm going to talk about the thing that fuels us to become more minimalist. Now, being minimalist means actually have fewer things in life. And that actually makes us healthier. You all know that, I trust, right? But what stops us from becoming minimalist is really what I want to go after. So I want to go upstream to what causes us not to become minimalist, so make us the opposite of minimalist. It actually make us destroyers of creation, to be brutally frank. So I want to go upstream a bit. And so I wanted to listen to the whole show, partly because I wanted to hear what people had to say about taking Good Friday. And the guest they had on said, you know, it would be better if we had a predictable day, sometime in March or April, that it's predictable, because Good Friday floats around a bit, right? And the other thing he said is it shouldn't be connected to a kind of a Christian observance. We live in a secular society, fewer and fewer people are going to church, and it shouldn't be Christocentric. And those are two really interesting arguments. And I'm okay with that. To be really frank, if society takes away Good Friday, if we take it away as a statutory holiday, I will still keep Good Friday. I'm not worried about my loss of Good Friday. Period. That's not a debatable issue for me. Right? And I also appreciate the argument that we are a tradition, a society shouldn't be dominated by a particular tradition, spiritual tradition. I'm okay with that in a secular society. I'm okay with those arguments. But one of the things I like about Good Friday is its unpredictability, that it floats around. In fact, I like the randomness of it. Because we live in a society that's so structured that we lose our flexibility and creativity. And the beautiful thing about a floating Good Friday, of all the holidays in the year, is it's a little unpredictable. Sometimes between the middle of March and the latter part of April, they can come anytime. And it's a nice surprise. But everything else is so stratified, so sterile. And years ago, remember when we had the debate about Sunday shopping and clothes? I'm knocking things over here, sorry. I don't mean to be destructive. But remember we had the argument years ago about Sunday shopping? And I'm completely fine with Christians with losing Sunday, making it a day of shopping in a sort of way. As long as we as a society hold on to a Sabbath day somewhere. Let's make Wednesday a Sabbath day. No, seriously. Because the day that we lost the Sabbath, the Sunday, but again, it could be a Friday. It could be a Saturday. It could be a Tuesday. I don't care what day it is. As a Christian, I will observe a Sunday. But if it is a Tuesday, then Tuesday's the day we all agree that we're going to pause and change the rhythm of life. Because on the day that we lost the Sabbath, as a day of observance, of changing our rhythm, two gods won that day. The God of commercialism and the God of convenience. They won. They're the invisible gods. They won because, see, now we don't have to do... Now, this is a really great thing. So I was talking to a very dear friend of mine she stayed with me. She's doing El Camino right now. She just started it. She stayed with me the night before she was traveling to go to Spain. And she brought me some jam. And she handed me the jam, and I took the jam, and she said, there's an ingredient in the jam, there's a spice in the jam. She lives in Tatamagush, and there's a spice in this jam. And it's a currant strawberry jam with a touch of lemon and another spice that I didn't know, but she told me what it was, and I can't tell you what it was, and I could contact her, but she's being a pilgrim right now, so I can't get it from her. And this is the story she said to me. She said, I needed this ingredient. I just needed a little bit of it. So I knew in the co-op or the food land in Tatamagush that they didn't have it. So I called the farmer's market, and there's a spice person there. So they didn't have it, and she wasn't working that day. So they said, here's her number. So she said, I called the woman in Tatamagush, the spice woman in Tatamagush, and she asked for this particular spice, and she said, well, I'm not selling any of it, but I have some of it at home. Why don't you come by at 5 o'clock, and I'll give you some. So she went by her house at 5 o'clock and got some. Right. Now, I don't know about you, but do you remember when Sundays were closed? I remember Sundays, my mom would send me to my neighbor's house because she'd forgotten to get flour for the gravy. Remember that? So I'd go to my neighbor's house, knock on the door, and ask for some flour. And I remember my neighbors coming every so often, and I might be home by myself, and a neighbor comes and says, I forgot to go to the market today. Can I borrow some sugar? We don't do that anymore. We don't have to do that anymore because the shops are open 24/7. We don't have to rely on each other anymore. We don't have to plan ahead anymore. It's all in front of us. And we've lost, I think, our capacity to be creative. Now, that's just not one of the arguments for the Sabbath, but it's also really good for us and for me, and I won't speak for you, but for me to rest, to take time where I actually can't do anything except rest, to pause. So the day we lose Sabbath, the day we lose Good Friday, the day we lose random moments in time, we lose our capacity to be creative. My concern about regimenting all our holidays is we become kind of like cattle. We're just moved through lines. I love when things are a little random, and my creativity and spontaneity has to change and alter in response to it. So let's go upstream. Why do we fight being minimalist? Well, a part of it is we become addicted. I become addicted to consuming, because consuming is a new god. We have to consume. My society tells me to consume. Years ago, I went on a retreat with the DeKalb Carmelite monk, and we arrived, and I don't know about you guys, but I'm busy. And the other thing is I'm a voracious reader. So I go into this retreat with a monk, and the monk sits and looks at us all. We're all like you, I think, for the most part. You all look like you read a fair bit and pay attention quite a bit. And he said this to me. He said to us in retreat, he looked at us very sternly, and he said, "Stop reading good books. Don't read another good book for the rest of your life. You're too tired. You're too busy. Stop reading good books." And then he paused for about 5 minutes. And that's like a knife in my heart. Don't read. And what's he talking about? After 5 minutes of absolute silence, read only excellent books. I share that with you, and I know some of you are a little younger than others. He saved me thousands of dollars. he really has. Because I don't know about you, when I go into a bookstore, one of my addictions is books. And I pick up books, and I look at the book, and I say, "Oh, that's a good book." And I put it down, because it's only a good book, right? I now read reviews of books to make sure it's an excellent book. And now the reviewers who I now like, and I say I like them because they only review good books or give an excellent book an excellent evaluation. I listen to you when you tell me, "This is an excellent book." Actually, what I'll do, you may talk to me after church, after worship, and say, "I know a really good book." I say, "But it has an excellent book. It saved me thousands and thousands of dollars." And I'm actually downsizing my office right now, which is another minimalist guide to the galaxy, because I'm actually going to be giving my books away. I went about 2 years ago, I went to the funeral of my cousin, second cousin, and it was a beautiful funeral. Actually, it wasn't a beautiful funeral. It was a very secular funeral. I didn't think it was very good at all. But it did a really good thing. He was a voracious reader, and they had his library at the funeral. Yeah, that's a great idea. I'm going to do this. Just to let you know, when I die in 150 years, I'm going to ask my family to bring my library to the funeral, and you can all take a book or two. But that's an aside. We don't need as much as we think we need. We need to have less in life and reprioritize life and fight against those things that trap us, that say we have to be slaves to the gods of consumerism and convenience. The gods of consumerism and the gods of convenience. Every time we give something away and share it, we have fought against the god of consumerism. One of my dearest friends, a few years ago, I took up running more voraciously, and I lost 15 pounds. And I've kind of kept it off. I'm injured right now. I'm an injured runner. I do have an addiction to running shoes, by the way. So just so you know, I do have addictions. I lost 15 pounds, and I gave all my clothes to one of my best friends because I couldn't fit in them anymore. With the absolute guarantee that I will not put that weight back on, right? Because if I do, I'll have to be naked, right? So I gave all my clothes away. And now I see my suit the other night at a dinner party. It was really great. But we give it away. We give it away. And it has a new life. And we are not giving in to the god of consumerism. And we fight against it. One of the really critical things in our world, too, for me, is going back to those things that are really precious, that ground us. And so, as a chaplain, I used to love to ask people, what really means the most to you in the universe? What are the really important things? If I really got to know you, I would ask you the question, what's really precious to you? What's really precious to you? What's really precious to you? And as you know, no one has ever said to me, Jody, the thing that's most precious to me was that raise that I received. Or the golden handshake I received at the end of my work life. Or the commendation I received for working extra. No one has ever said that to me. No one has ever said that to me. Have they ever said that to you? At the end of their life. No one has ever said that to me. And I work with thousands of people at the end of their lives. And it's a great privilege. And what's most precious to them at that moment are their relationships. That's the key. And how can we filter that into how we live our lives, how I live my life right now? The relationships are the most important thing. So I was working with a Catholic Russian priest. Now, a Catholic Russian priest was connected to the Orthodox Church, although he was Catholic, Roman Catholic. They were affiliated with the Roman Catholic Church, but he could marry. And so I got to know him fairly well. His name was Father Joseph. And I'm Jody. So I would go at the end of the day. At the end of every day, I would go and visit him. And he was in our psychiatric unit. And he was in there for assessment because of some of his behavior. He was an older man. And every day, I would go in and I would speak to Father Joseph. And we'd have a lovely conversation. But we weren't sure what his diagnosis was. And midway through the time, about 3 weeks into his hospitalization, we realized that we're dealing with a dementia of sorts. And not a mental illness overtly, but a dementia. At the end of each day, this is how our day would end, our pattern of day, time together would end. And I would say, I have to leave Father Joseph. And he would always, big priest, big hands. When he went to Edmonton, he actually helped them build a cathedral. Like, he worked with the laborers. He worked with the laborers to build a cathedral with the men and women who built the building. It's 15 minutes, sorry. I'll just hear it. I'll tell you, I've got two more stories and then we're all done. Stop. Alright. So he was laboring, had these huge hands, and at the end of our time together, I would say, Father Joseph, it's time for me to leave. And Father Joseph would kneel in front of me. It's really humbling. He would put his head in my lap. And he would say, Father Jody, pray for me. And I'd put my hands on his head and I'd pray for him. I'd get up and he'd give me a big bear hug. And then I go down and I'd leave. That would be the last visit of the day. What a holy way to spend the last visit of the day, right? It was an amazing man. And we talked about everything. But his mind would sometimes go, right? So one day, I went to Father Joseph, same ritual. I said, Father Joseph, I had to go. He said, Father Jody, pray for me. He knelt down, prayed for me. He got up, gave him a hug. And this time, this is what I did. This is the key. I said to him, just before I said that, I said, Father Joseph, what's the most precious thing to you? What's the most precious thing to you? The most precious thing. And he didn't answer me right away. He didn't answer the question. And then I said, Father Joseph, I have to leave. And we prayed and he got up. And this day, for the first time ever, instead of going back into his bed or sitting in the chair, he walked with me down the hallway to the elevator. And I don't know if you've ever been in hospital elevators, but they're always slow. But there's always a whole group of people, right? Well, there was nobody there. 5 o'clock in the evening, I press the elevator to go down. Father Joseph, the elevator door opens, and I'm stepping into the elevator. And Father Joseph looks at me, and he says, a long, lingering kiss. Isn't it beautiful?
Yeah.
The answer to the question, the answer to the secret of the universe, a long, lingering kiss from an old priest at the end of his life when his mind is going, says with crystal clarity, the most precious thing in the world is a long, lingering kiss. Now, we can have that long, lingering kiss between lovers. Or how about the long, lingering kiss between sisters and brothers between a mother and child and a child and a mother, between neighbors and friends. In a sterile world where the gods of consumerism and the gods of convenience come rushing in and treat us like cattle, we lose our capacity for long lingering kisses. Now sometimes they're with the mouth, but sometimes they're with deep conversation, with eye contact, with not paying attention to the time, but actually really sharing what's critical to who we are as human beings. The more things I have, the more things I grasp at, the more things I possess, the less able I am, the less able we are to have those conversations, to share in that wisdom, to take time to pause and to listen. The Minimalist Guide to the Galaxy is based on our desire for long, lingering kiss, and to fight all those things that stop us from paying attention to each other, paying attention to my neighbor. I'll end with one final story. It's a little longer, but I want to talk about the danger of neighborhood just because it's such a critical story. Years ago, I was a parish priest in Westfall, and my youth group raised money for a little girl who wasn't a member of our parish. Her name was Jennifer Moyer, and Jennifer had Fanconi's aplastic anemia and needed a bone marrow transplant. It was IWK, it was in the mid-80s. And my youth group were a group of juvenile delinquents. They really were. My brother used to say in Dartmouth, when my youth group met, the crime rate dropped in Westfall. It's not funny. They were a tough bunch of kids. So they raised $500 for Jennifer Moyer. So they raised the money and they gave it to me. And I phoned the IWK and I said to the IWK, I've got all this money, $500 for Jennifer. I'd never met Jennifer before. What do I do with the money? This bunch of juvenile delinquents had raised $500, and the IWK said to me, why don't you hold on to the money, and when she goes for surgery, we'll call you. And about 2 weeks later, the IWK called me and asked if I would be a public trustee for Jennifer Moyer. What do you do when your juvenile delinquent youth group raises $500 and the IWK calls you to be a public trustee? What do you do? I said yes. Just really profoundly stupid. But I said yes because my youth group had said, this is what we're going to do. So I thought it would be sacrilegious for me not to do that, not to be a trustee. So I asked the IWK what it meant to be a trustee, and they said, all you have to do is sign checks. And I said, yeah, right, exactly right. So I said, sure, that's super cool. On the 21st of December, the IWK calls me. I'm in my office with my secretary, Audrey, and I'm in the office 21st of December, and they say to me, Jody, Jennifer's got her surgery. It's in Chicago. We need $25,000. I said, that's cool. Just raising money. No, I said, you're in charge of raising $25,000. Yeah, I'm not kidding. On the 21st of December. So I called all my friends in the Lions Club, Rotary Club, all the clubs, the Odd Fellows, you name it. I phoned them. I said, guys, could you give me some money for Jennifer, right? And they said, Jody, it's the 21st of December. We spent all our money. We have no money. But we'll help you in February and March when we're back in our cycle. But right now we have no money. So my stomach was empty, and I didn't know what to do. And we raised about $1,000, $3,000 or $4,000. We needed 25. We moved it then to Vancouver instead of Chicago. That was a relief. Dropped down to $20,000. We needed $20,000, and we did a public release, a phone release, press release in the Country and Western station. Picked it up. It was the only station that picked it up. We ran the Country and Western station. And the Bank of Montreal in Willan Branch offered, in those days, you had to actually go to the bank. Remember those days? Once upon a time, you used to actually go to the bank and put money in the bank and have tellers. So you had to go to the bank physically and make a donation to Jennifer Moyer Fund. Right? So I'd go in every day, and the operation moved from December to March. And every day I'd go into the bank. The bank tellers got to know me really, really well. And so I'd go in, and it would go by. So we were about $3,000. The women's group of my parish put in $2,000 or $5,000. I go in the next day, it's $6,000 and $6,500. And then I go in 2 days later, $7,500. And we're getting closer and closer to the time of surgery, right? And my anxiety level is going up. And we're about $12,000. We need $20,000. Canadian Pacific Airline donates the air tickets. Okay, that helps us a little bit. We still need about $17,000, $18,000. We're at $12,000. Jennifer's got to have the surgery. Now, at this point, I know Jennifer and her parents really well. They're dear friends. They're members of the Roman Catholic Parish. They've now become close friends. I'm involved with them on a daily basis. And then one day, it was a Tuesday or Wednesday morning, I go into the Bank of Montreal, and everybody knows me. All the tellers now know me. And I walk in, and I don't know if you know this, there used to be lineups in the bank. So there'd be like 25 people. I walked in this day, and the tellers, about four of them, were so excited. They were just, Joey, come here. And about four of them came to the side, and I went to the side, right? And everybody's looking, well, who the hell is this guy, right? And got over to the side, and I said, Joey, remember, we're about $14,000. One donation, $2,800. So that got us really close to $20,000. That was a big jump, right? We're almost there. We're so there that it's we can fill in the rest, right? We knew we'd make it. $2,800. And I thought initially that I'd write thank you notes to all the people that donated money. That was kind of silly because it was all in $20, $40, $12, $2 increments, right? $2,800. One donation. And I said, who's the donation from? And they said, now, I don't know if you know, for those who haven't lived in Halifax or Dartmouth for a long time, this is the mid-80s, and it came from a place called the Stern Wheeler. For people who once lived in Halifax or Dartmouth, the Stern Wheeler was a strip club. It was. It was one of the toughest bars in Dartmouth, yeah? And the women took all the proceeds from one night of dancing, and they donated to Jennifer. Wow. Amazing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Sorry. Two parts of the story. It's almost over. I have a great regret. I didn't go down and thank them. If I could do it all again, I would go down and say thank you. I didn't because it's a strip club and I'm a priest and I'm thinking, today I would go up with my collar on stage and invite all the people who helped on stage and I want to say thank you. I didn't do it. I'm sorry. Because we're on the same team. And what I'm realizing is that we're on the same team. We all belong on the same team. That we're all working together. And what's critical for us to do is to see us as team members and not allow a society to say, you're in and you're out. You belong and you don't belong. That on that day, they were my sisters. And I was their brother. And we have to fight every force that tries to commodify us or keep us separate. Because the only thing that will guide our universe and our galaxy is our ability to be brother and sister to each other. And that's what transforms the world. It's been great flying with you today. Thank you so much.